Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fit against it, I only wish we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for anything I've done.
This is Rebel Yell. I'm your host, Masonius Rufus. On this week's episode of Rebel Yell, we talk to Ryan Landry of Social Matter. So, I'm from Tennessee, and Macon's Ghost is from Virginia. You don't have to tell us exactly where you're from, but are you from the South, Mr. Landry?
No, I'm about as far as you can get. I'm originally from Maine, and I live in the upper Midwest now. I live in Indiana.
Oh, cool, cool. Yeah, Maine, New England. When did you move to Indiana? How old were you, approximately?
I was well into adulthood. I was born and raised in the Northeast. I mean, I lived my whole life in Maine. I went to college in New York. And after college, I went back and I worked in New England for a few years, and then wanted to raise a family. And, you know, when we talk in the broader sphere about, you know, how blue states, you know, you just can't have kids. It is so true. For my wife and I to even have a family, I'd have been looking at like a 90-minute commute one way, and I didn't want to do that to my kids. So we looked around the map and looked at opportunities for jobs for me, and we ended up finding Indiana as kind of a perfect spot.
Well, since you know about Indiana, you probably know a lot more about the whole incident with the bakery and the wedding cake and such.
Yeah, and I consider Governor Pence, when they put the religious freedom, when they put that law in and he signed it, his response, besides being weak, it was incredibly – you could tell he was unprepared. But I don't think he had any clue that the entire media machinery was going to turn on him. And he seemed to be caught flat-footed, which I think is unusual for him because he's actually pretty good at strategy. But, I mean, his response was so weak, and he couldn't grasp that the two-minute hate would happen but then pass on by.
So he wasn't mentally prepared for – it was almost like a corporate cabal decided that they were going to make this an issue, right? Or something like that. Some sort of cabal decided they were going to push this really hard, really fast, and he wasn't ready at all for it.
Yeah, and it kind of stunned me because he seems to be decent at strategy stuff. I think it goes to show how a lot of these GOP establishment guys they kind of play. I've said it elsewhere that conservatives play as politics as a part of it's just a part of life. Whereas liberals play politics as politics is life. And I don't think he figured that out, that no, they were going to hate him for 2 minutes, but don't worry, that storm will pass and they'll find somebody new to hate 2 minutes later.
Right, right. And then what was just reading about the reaction on Wikipedia now, it's you know, there's all these different CEOs, there's all this you know, virtue signaling. Or what is it that the neo-reactionaries call that? They call it a holiness spiral.
Yeah, it's they all have to signal their virtue and signal that, you know, I'm a good person. I think, well, I'm against this legislation, you know, no matter where it is. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is that a liberal will tell you, oh, you don't like the gun laws in Massachusetts? Well, you can move. You know, they'll tell you that. But imagine saying it to a homosexual being like,
yeah,
you know, hey,
shit.
Look, you know, hey, look, faggy pants, get the hell out of here. You know, if you don't want to get, if you don't like our rules, go to another state. They'd cry foul, and then the entire Acela corridor would come down and call you a bad person.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. Can you imagine, they gave the same reciprocity, or you expected the same reciprocity for like your handgun carry permit as for like, say, you know, gay marriages in other states, that would be, foreboding. That would be beyond the pale, you know, to ask. You know, for the same kind of reciprocity, because that's different.
Yeah,
know?
Which is actually something that Trump has made a platform this time around.
And that was a smart move by him. One thing that I've liked that he does is he takes the principled exceptions that are allowed by our overlords, and he spins it on them. I mean, look at what he says and does with the wall and immigration. He says, hey, if Israel can do it, why can't we? And, yeah, you know, he plays dumb about it, but you know, and I know, and he knows that they get that exception for a certain reason. And he did it with, you know, Henry's right that he did it with the gun carry laws, where he's like, if I can do it in Nebraska, I should be able to do it in Virginia, and I should be able to do it in Massachusetts. Why isn't there that type of legal reciprocity? And I'd say the thing that's more scary about gun laws is that, you know, you've seen our federal Obama administration say, well, we can't do laws, but we're doing other things. And then you start piecing together the stuff that they're doing at the federal level, and whether that's buying up every bit of ammunition they can find to push up rates, or whether they're going and saying, okay, we're smuggling guns to the Mexicans, and there's all these hot guns out there, we got to worry about it. Well, the hot guns are only there because you were selling them. But they're always finding ways to try a backdoor way of making them illegal.
Right, right. Project, was it Fast and Furious? You're referring to that, where they were selling it to – they were making sure that Mexican cartels, these drug narco cartels, were buying guns from American gun stores, who knew that they were nefarious characters, but they were basically ordered by the DOJ to do this. And it seems like the whole point, which is, you know, to me should have been very scandalous, and it was very scandalous on the internet, you know, among the patriots and stuff. The whole point seemed to have been to smear gun ownership so that they could go after it domestically. You see, you American gun nuts are causing violence in Mexico. I mean, it was a great crime on several different levels.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think is interesting, and part of what I saw the political reality to it, and I do think it's interesting that as soon as Fast and Furious and Gunwalker, those programs were unearthed and saw some daylight, those got shut down, and then magically we started seeing more media attention on mass gun violence, you know, mass shootings that came out of nowhere. The thing that I think is interesting is there was something that was lost in the whole media debate, where the media used to be able to point to gun violence and go, oh man, guns are terrible. After a while, you know, you see enough black faces on television that are with all those gun crimes. You're like, no, it's more blacks killing each other. And that's the problem. It's almost like the feds and the left needed a new way to smear gun owners, as you said, by saying, look, you know, these cartels have guns, and look at all these people getting their heads cut off, and that, you know, their chest shot, you know, shot in. And it's because of you gun salesmen. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, give me a moment. Let me add, Ryan, I'm still trying to add him to our conversation. Make it's Ghost, would you like to ask our guest a question, or do you have a specific question you'd like to start off on?
I guess just the general introduction. Part of the problem is, again, because Ryan is the guy who set up this interview, neither one of us has really been introduced to you. So we didn't really get the 5-minute introduction to who you were.
I only know you from the past reading of Neo Reaction. 28 Sherman is your blog, and you also blog on Social Matter. Is that all right that I say that? I'll cut anything out, of course, that you don't want.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been blogging. Oh God, it was like, I think it started like 10 years ago, and just a regular, you know, sports, poker, politics, and money kind of blogging. And you know, then I decided, I don't know, part of it was getting older, and I think a thing for me, a turn, was as the Obama administration went into play, and then on me on a personal level, my wife and I had our first child, started thinking about, okay, you know, change up my writing, you know, what was I seeing around there, and then what I had privy to just from what I work with in the financial, insurance, and real estate world. There was enough things that with that big financial crisis, and there were a lot of rats jumping off the ship, and there were a lot of rats that we were bailing out. I kind of viewed it as, okay, if there's something I know or something I can see, you know, start to share that. And I mean, I've been blogging at 28 Sherman, yeah, for about a decade. I wrote for a while at Thedon, if you guys remember Thedon. I wrote for a while there. I mean, it's Neo-Reaction, and Neo-Reaction, alt-right, the right stuff, all that stuff. We're all part of the same family, you know, like different cousins in the family.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like, the alt-right, it's, I always try to use the neo-reactionary trichotomy. You know, those are the right-wing, that's the right-wing alliance that needs to be made, you know, between, fundies or theonomists and libertarians and then nationalists of, you know, we need all that knowledge. We need that alliance and we don't need to be purging each other. So, yeah. Yeah, I consider the alt-right just to be, or neo-reaction to be part of the alt-right, even though I know that it's very, specific and it was first. Cause, I think of the alt-right as going back to Mencius Moldbug myself. Was it 2008 or 2007 when he started writing that I first remember?
Yeah, one thing that I think's, powerful for the alt-right is how it's decentralized. And you get a lot of different nodes of power or viewpoints, as you said, a lot of really different viewpoints there. One thing that I think is strong, and I mean, you're a Southern guy. I think the Southern identity, I think that's a strong point because within America, and you know, you got a lot of deracinated whites, you got a lot of Hispanics who don't feel patriotic towards America. You have a lot of blacks who are taught basically to hate America and hate the federal government despite existence with food and funds. One of the few remaining strong identities is that Southern, you know, if you call it a cracker identity, but that Southern white identity. You know, Dixie's still a strong rally point, and I think that's whether it's the Dixie secession guys or just, you know, the Southern nationalists, I think that's actually a strong viewpoint.
Mm, yeah, you're right. Let me see if Ryan is here. Ryan, is that you?
Yep.
Oh, excellent. Ryan McMahon, Ryan Landry, Mencius Ghost. We're all together now. And, Mr. Landry just made a point about Southern identity, how it's, you know, uniquely, it's got unique properties that make it, you know, make it especially good, you know, because we have an identity within the American identity, I think is what, you know, is what makes us unique. And, Ryan, do you have any questions for our guests that you'd like to start out with?
Did you guys just start off with mentioning the Southern, like the way you just covered earlier?
Yeah, we started off talking about just introductions and, you know, where we're from. And then we started with neo-reaction, but we've moved quickly to Southern identity.
Which is probably a good place to move into there, just talk about maybe nationalism, where we are today, ethno-nationalism, and maybe what's left of the paleo movement to the extent it does exist at all anymore.
Yeah, I identify highly with the paleos. And like you pointed out the... you called it cracker. That, you know, that was interesting because, you know, cracker actually refers to a speech act, you know, loud people. I've looked it up. It was actually a form of classicism, you know, looking down on the lower classes, you know, centuries ago. And that seems to be one of the unique problems if you're just a WASP or you're a white person in America, is that everyone wants to, you know, show off their high class and look down on those lower class white people. And those seem to be the only acceptable enemy. And, you demote agency from anyone, you know, who's black and lower class or Latino. You demote agency from women, but those lower class whites, they have agency. They're fully culpable for their awful ways. And, you know, we're allowed to hate them and status signal how much we're not them. And, but, you know, cracker's not a bad word to the South. You know, they took it as a, you know, a rebellious word. It's like, yeah, damn right I'm a cracker. You know, and, you know, Florida, the identity of Florida especially is wrapped up with, crackers. You know, I think that's interesting. Even centuries ago, we were, status signaling our high status. You know, those crackers with their, you know, they're noisy and boisterous and they fight and they're, you know, I'm refined. I'm a gentleman. You know, I'm not like one of those loud crackers. And, we still do that today, except we have all these other people that, you know, we demote agency from. It's one of the problems with being, was it Messiah or being white Messiah? Or we can go into the neo-reactionary castes here in a minute and explain what those are. But,
you know, one thing, like today on Twitter, I shared a link from a writer. His name's, he's a financial writer, but he's spread out to, I mean, he's gone, I don't want to say like, you know, full alt-right or whatever, but he's now naming everyone. And his name's Russ Winter, and he's actually the son of the famous basketball coach Tex Winter. And he's someone who he's like, look, you know, I'm a cracker. I'm from old stock Southern guys. And he's like, you know, we're the people who have fought your wars. We're the people who have grown your food. We're the people who have done, you know, built this country. and you know, you create us, you know, if you create us into a villain. One thing I'd say about the Southern identity that I think makes it hardier, and it's something that I've noticed when I've been doing research or just reading up on the heroin epidemic, is the heroin epidemic, it's not as bad down south as it is in other regions of America. And somebody had once talked to me about the Southern identity America. It's one of the few groups of Americans that knows defeat and destruction and also knows victory. I mean, the Southern men have made the backbone of the American military machine. I mean, they've gone through and destroyed God knows how many enemies America has had. But the loss from the Civil War, it's almost like the Southern identity is a complete whole, whereas the rest of America only is told of a forever progressing, forever winning identity. And I think that that's something that's important, because we're getting to that point where Trump, when he campaigns, you know, it's let's win again, let's be great again. People are catching on of decline and decay. And if you have a culture or society or an identity that has always won, that first loss is going to be cataclysmic. It's going to be such a shredder of the identity that I think that the Southern identity is going to be a lot hardier and stronger during that kind of crisis and stress.
Yeah, I think you're right. Macon, would you like to add something?
I think in some way regional identity and something I think is a legitimate nationality and nationalism is something that I think we will see a resurgent of during any kind of upheaval, especially if we do see some kind of social turmoil combined with economic turmoil in the future, which is something that I think everybody across the alt-right, libertarians, even mainstream thinkers are expecting sometime in the next few decades. So despite a lot of trends on some people on the alternative right to think that, you know, regionalism or, you know, Southern nationalism is going away, I think the opposite is completely true. And I think we'll probably see a resurgence of Southern nationalism, Southern identitarianism as something being more firm and a more solid identitarian movement in the United States, as it were.
Yeah, you can see with the Trump campaign, it's the solid South, you know, like minus Texas, which, you know, Cruz comes from Texas. But you see a very, you know, it's the Southern voting bloc is back, you know, in force.
Yeah, but even last summer, I mean, what we saw after the Charleston shooting and the cultural attack on the Confederate battle flag and, you know, Confederate symbolism across the South, it was an attack on the mythology of the Lost Cause. In a lot of ways, it was more or less the establishment, the narratives, you know, capital N, large italicization, maybe large scare quotes around it, narratives attack on, or maybe we could even call it an outright Kulturkampf on Scots-Irish culture by the establishment, the acceptable establishment in the United States. So in some ways, this is still a carryover of cultural conflict in the English speaking people's experience that goes back 400 or 500 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like there's been an attack on them for a long time, and it like accelerated. They're like, oh boy, another weapon to use against them, because, you know, if you want to show off your charity, your telescopic philanthropy, there's plenty of poor people in Appalachia you can do it for.
Yeah.
And but for some reason, it's like, nah, they deserve that. We would rather replace them with foreigners, or, you know, a proper, you know, target of our charity or something. And
yeah,
go on.
Yeah, I was even going to talk. I mean, I remember around 2012 when we did see the large polarization in the libertarian movement between those groups that moved towards the alt-right and those that became complete sellouts, to be frank, was when we started seeing the discussion of privilege. And I remember pretty clearly when Kathy Reisenwitz talked about that going, you know, when she was moving into D.C. and talking about, you know, the privilege of being white and driving past black neighborhoods on her way to Starbucks. And my very clear, specific comment when I was talking to a friend was, look, because I do live in Virginia, is there's significantly poorer people who live in the opposite direction. If she happened to have driven west instead of east in Virginia, she could have gone into coal country and she could have seen people who live significantly poorer by any standard, any quantitative standard, anywhere in North America than those people she happened to have driven past. And it became immediately clear from the beginning that political correctness in all its forms is entirely about virtue signaling, and it is. It is explicitly a culture war against a group that the establishment has decided that it is trying to wage a genocidal conflict against.
One thing I interject is a big thing of like those, you know, the Rising Whites types in your Northeast liberals that are the Brahmin class, if you will, the folks who are your tastemakers, your culture molders. Those folks, as far as if you were to interact with any, as far as they were to interact with any black, I'd say before Obama was elected in 2008, the only black family they knew were the Huxtables on The Cosby Show. That's it. That is it. And I mean, full complete family. Cause then they went off to college. They probably ran into their, you know, their Oreo black friend or, you know, their talented 10th black friend or their legacy admission to Harvard or Princeton or whatever.
Yeah.
And then when the Obamas were elected, that was probably the first complete black family that they had seen and interacted with. And when I go home to Maine, Maine's about 97% white. When you hear them talk, I refer to the folks like in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. I refer to them as hobbits. And I'd even say the Wisconsin folks who just had their primary last night to timestamp this. These are folks who are in incredibly white states who have no concept of the many different niche groups within America, the many different classes. And they live in this la-la land where, oh, no. You know, I've been told if they just get educated, they're going to think just like me. And
yeah.
For them, they can virtue signal. And that's partly what this whole immigration thing is. For them, the greatest win that a liberal could have is you take in some ruffian Muslim, you clean him up, and you make him suddenly saying, yay, gays are good, and I love feminism. Like, for them, that would be such a win. So even though it's practically an impossibility, they'll still struggle for that.
Mm-hmm. Like a rescue animal.
Yeah,
a pet.
Yeah. Except rescue dogs don't rape your daughter.
Yeah, this is interesting. Going back to one of our earlier podcasts with Michael Cushman, I was thinking about the Southern identity and how there's 2 points I'd like to make. You know, number one, like in Appalachia, it's not very, ethnically diverse either. You know, West Virginia, Kentucky, East Tennessee, Appalachia, you know, you have to get, further and further south, you know, before you start running into like large groups of blacks. But somehow, you know, they don't have the same problem. And, because they still have that, identity. And, it seems like these Whitopian states are completely disarmed when it comes to identity politics. And, a common, thesis on the alt-right is, well, that's why the South is so based, is because you can't ignore the race issues. Well, going back to Michael Cushman, while talking to him, I realized that, you know, the Deep South has this plantation culture. It has a lot of identity. You know, there's a lot of identity difference between like the blacks, the black belt, and the whites that live in the black belt. So all that makes sense. You know, the alt-right thesis is correct. But there's something about Appalachia. It's like these people have always been more archaic, more hostile. They have always had their own identity, and they don't need like the presence of different identities, you know, to still be, you know, reactionary or old fashioned culturally. So I don't know where to go with that, but I think that's interesting. You know, the reason why we're Southern, with the Deep South is because of the Civil War. There's nothing like having a common, enemy. And, even though Appalachia tried to stay out of it, you know, we've been lost ever since. But, Ryan, would you like to add something?
One thing I mentioned in HBD chick, you know, despite her autism, you know, she has a point with that whole Hajna line and the idea of different populations being a little bit more clannish and, you know, in-group focused. And if you take a look at what you were just talking about, you know, with the Scotch Irish and with the areas you were discussing, West Virginia, Western Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama, Tennessee, a lot of folks who settle there are the folks who check the box, I'm American, you know, and they see that identity, but they're also from populations in Europe that were a little bit more clannish, a little bit more in-group focus, more honor-bound. And one thing I'd stress, and I've done a lot of business with folks in Alabama, is the folks from northern Alabama, you know, they call lower Alabama L.A. And they're like, whoa, 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 you know, we ain't from L.A., you know, we're northern Alabama. And I say, oh, is it just because the old, you know, plantation stuff down south? And they said, you know, northern Alabama were your small plot farmers, a lot of whites, a lot of Scotch-Irish, you know, a lot of even, you know, Protestants who were hardscrabble tough guys. Down southern Alabama was where your plantations were. So you had these incredibly wealthy, you know, optimate type whites, and then the blacks, you know, that were part of that southern black belt in that stretch of Alabama. So while even though northern Alabama is incredibly white and monoethnic or homogenous, it still had an identity separate from that southern Alabama bit. So they don't have to be exposed and they don't have to be swimming amongst the mix of lower Alabama, but there's a pride and a value in knowing you want to keep that away.
Mr. McMahon, do you have something to add?
Oh, I thought it was interesting. Like, I've been reading, it's been like floating around on Twitter recently, but I've read this in the past, the concept of passivism, where, like, I would think of, you know, Ryan Landry is familiar with it, but it's basically this idea, instead of like activism, like you hit the streets and you try to make noise and get what you want from the system, it was, you know, it's crumbling, so you build up like a shadow infrastructure to replace this, you know, falling apart one. And sovereign identity is basically like a replacement. So like, let's say America collapses, American identity's gone, everyone else is so atomized and so community, like, what, they're kind of screwed, they're in trouble. Especially like around here, it's, you know, if our identity by South America is like, you know, like the Mexican one, it's gonna be, you know, just gangs and, you know, like the El Chapo will take over. They all, it's like a folk throughout, even here. It's kind of horrible. I should probably move.
Yeah, I shudder to think what's gonna happen to California if there were ever, you know, a collapse, you know, like the apocalyptic literature, you know, you know, entails, like Patriots or, you know, the collapse literature after 2008, especially.
Yeah. One of the ironies, as an aside, is because of that, the Appalachian sides, the places that seem to most identify as Southerners as a result of those places that were small plot farmers were the places that, you know, during the war itself and, you know, prior to secession, that probably least, you know, were fans or least for the secessionist cause. These were places that were least necessarily advocates or supporters of the Confederate States of America. Some of these were counties that either actively supported the Union or actively didn't, you know, necessarily participate in a great deal for either side. But because of the experience of Reconstruction, it sort of reinforced that culturally, no matter what politically, but culturally, that they were Southerners as a result of being an occupied force, that they weren't given a choice, that they were forced to become Southerners because they were Appalachians.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like, the Deep South was, you know, producing most of the goods that were being exported. You know, so that goes along with the thesis that the tariff was the, you know, the original cause of the sectional conflict. And, but Appalachia, which wasn't producing all this cotton for export, they weren't being looted. And in fact, some of the farmers in Kentucky or Tennessee, if you were growing hemp, well, you could actually, you know, cooperate with the protectionist Yankee and say, hey, I'm going to make more money by growing hemp, which is why the only Southern vote ever, you know, for the Morrill Tariff was, you know, from, Tennessee. I'm sad to say. And I know that East Tennessee tried to secede the same way that West Virginia did, except West Virginia was so close to the Union that they decided that they were going to keep that illegal possession, you know, in case they lost the war. And so West Virginia's been separate ever since. But we were able to keep East Tennessee, and Kentucky decided, well, I just want to stay out of it. And you know, since the South, you know, technically invaded them first, and there was no way to protect themselves from the Union because of the Ohio River, that you know, they decided to go Union, but it was you know, they weren't all about it. You know, the fever of you know, the Yankee fever was coming from, you know, Pennsylvania, the industrialist North, New York. And anyway, that's, you know, that's interesting that Appalachia would have stayed out of the Civil War if it could.
Yeah.
And, you know, but now it's Southern, and you even have, you know, people flying rebel flags in Pennsylvania, which is above the Mason-Dixon line, but yeah, it's part of the Appalachian culture.
And it's Scots-Irish to a large extent once you get into the Appalachian areas.
Yeah, yeah. So we're actually expanding culturally.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think to a large extent, that's something I bring up. Just to point out that, you know, to a large extent, Southern nationalism is a true nationalism. It is a true identitarian movement. It's more than, you know, the neo-confederacy, you know, political identity movement or something like that. It is, you know, a legitimate identitarian movement, I think, in that sense.
Mm-hmm. One thing to go back to what Ryan McMahon was making reference to, the passivism, activism split or just discussion that's recently been out there. One thing I'd say to keep in mind is, you know, a lot of people forget that with the whole integration bit, I mean, the folks down south didn't want it. They had their police forces out there, and then magically the federal government went down there with even bigger guns and got what they wanted. A lot of people forget that in Boston, when they pushed integration and the Boston busing riots were just one part of it. And, you know, the Irish Toughs, and, you know, just, I remember my family telling me stories about it, but in the early 70s when that happened, the Irish Toughs were just one part of it. There were other people who didn't want the busing who tried peaceful methods, and they tried the whole, you know, sit-in type crap, you know, the peaceful protest. Mm-hmm. And these were women, and the cops were ordered, go in there, crack some skulls, and those women will run. And that is exactly what happened. You never, ever hear about that. That's never, it's never discussed in the history of it. It's always, there were some racist Irish people who shook some buses, and, you know, we showed them, and in the process, they destroyed Boston's busing. I think one thing to keep in mind with the whole activism, pacifism thing is, you can see it right now with what's going on in Europe, where the police are nowhere to be found to actually protect Europeans from what's going on from the immigration invaders. And then magically they come out with their fire hoses, whether it's Belgian nationalists, German nationalists, it does not matter. They are out there spraying them, and then they're also out there saying, oh, if you happen to do anything, we're going to charge you with terror charges. But they somehow cannot find a single rapist to prosecute, or they're doing even worse. Somebody shared a link where it was said that some victim was made to testify that it was the rape was her fault. You know, when you have that type of power lined up against you, the moment you try something activist, they're going to go after you. I mean, that's where the whole pacifism thing is. You know, you kind of build shadow systems, you build networks, and you build networks they're going to be able to take over or execute safe, you know, provide safety, execute on basic functions, keeping the trains running on time. One thing I'd mention, and this is just a thought experiment, Buzz, but think about what's going on with police forces across America. They're actually having their duties and the ability to execute their orders are hampered because if you touch anybody who's beyond beige, you know, you have to be really dark, but you touch somebody dark just doing your job, whether you kick them when you arrest them or yell at them too much or pin them down when they're in a bathing suit, like happened in Texas, your ass can be fired.
And right.
That's part of a push, and you can see it coming, where the left wants federal control and federal oversight of local police forces. It's because they don't trust those local police forces. Also going to want to force them to start looking like what the left's voting coalition is. If you were to think about, okay, what's an institution I could build? Well, one thing you could do is take advantage of a lot of these small towns are running into money problems, cannot afford their cops. So what if you created, you know, like a private security firm, and a private security firm that offered to provide policing services, you know, police services to small towns, and say, look, you don't have to keep cops anymore, but we will provide what you need. You know, large, you know, murders that happen get referred to the sheriff's office, you know, for processing. We can do your normal patrolling. We can answer normal calls. You can end up creating private security forces that will replace the public, you know, the public police force that won't be subject to the public police force, you know, the eye of Sauron from the left. And that private force, you end up staffing with guys like, you know, the four of us. If you can build an institution and you can control who's in that private firm, that's a bit of a way of pacifism, but also building a separate institution that'll have control and be able to provide security, which I think is, that's going to be the most important thing probably in the 2020s, is can you keep an area secure?
Well, there's a lot there. You know, you covered like the fact that the Brahmins are upper class, are conspiring with the lower classes against the middle, right? The Dalits and the Helots, the Helots being the the immigrants, and the Dalits being the underclass, and the Brahmins are using them against us. And so we're definitely of the Optimates and the Visayas, you know, definitely Visaya, right? Those are the all five castes according to the neo-reactionaries, right?
I think later on, Molbug condensed it all to, it's the Eloi, which are like the Brahmins, and the Morlocks, which are like the underclass, versus the middle, like us just old Americanas. And that's, I mean, you can see it going on.
Yeah.
Like right now where, I mean, think about when you look at a, whether it's a Bernie or a Hillary rally, you've got these really, really faggy looking white guys. You know, some white chicks with the tattoos or the purple colored hair. And then the other voters are, you know, you're normally overweight, obese, whether blacks or Hispanics. That's their voter block. And you couldn't get any more opposite than what those two are.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that shows that, it's these two different classes are conspiring against the middle. You know, that shows in Technicolor.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to what you said. You know, you just reminded me when you said to anyone darker than beige, you know, I would say like darker than a brown paper bag. That's the old joke. You know, of how you determine, you know, who's victim class and who's the victimizer. And then you talked about private security forces. And I'd like to add something here about how our system was originally set up to avoid any kind of monopoly, our justice system. So, technically speaking, if you did provide some sort of, you know, security, well, you know, you can take anyone to the grand jury. Oh, Macon got dropped. I'm going to add him back. But yeah, so you don't have to be a police officer to take someone who's committing a felony to arrest someone who's committing a felony, and you can take anyone to a grand jury or a magistrate. So if the cops are becoming too moribund through bureaucracy, yeah, that you could actually do that, what you're describing, you know, and still keep the old English system of common law, you know.
Yeah, and I think that like you're seeing it too with whether, I don't know if you guys read up on like what's going on in Detroit, where, you know, Detroit has a much smaller police force now, but it's stretched very thin. It's ineffective. You know, there's crimes rampant in Detroit. These new little neighborhoods that pop up where they're trying to pull in the Swipples and the artsy folks. And whether it's Dan Gilbert, you know, billionaire Jew who's trying to try to sell them. They also pitch the idea that there are security cameras everywhere and that you have private security, so you're not reliant upon the cops in Detroit. I do think that that's going to pop up more because behind all this, you know, record gun ownership or record background checks, it's not as much people going, yay, I like guns, as much as it's people saying, you can't provide basic security. I don't trust that you're going to get to root causes. I'm going to put a gun in my hand because I'm fearful somebody is going to try to break in.
Yeah. And, thank the Lord. One of the few things the right's been able to accomplish, maybe the only thing is, getting those carry permits, getting the right to carry, weapons. Because when I was young back in the 80s, it was the dark times when it came to the right to, you know, carry weapons, to own weapons. And we've gone from, may issue to shall issue, all over this, country. It's fun to watch the map on Wikipedia. If you, go over there, you're like, wow, the right wing actually wanted something. You know, the left is on the defensive, you know, California, Illinois, you know, they're the holdouts. You know, the right has swept Wisconsin. We've taken Wisconsin and Iowa and these traditionally progressive Whitopian states when it comes to the right to carry weapons. So I think you're right. I think it's the fear of crime, and that's probably one of the greatest things that have kept crime from actually growing. You know, because it's been shrinking most of my life, and then it started rebounding, I guess, a couple years ago. And Lord knows what it would have. What it would have been if it hadn't been for the liberalization of gun rights.
Well, one thing to keep in mind too is I think folks in the middle of the 20th century didn't worry about gun ownership as much because they actually trusted the police to be effective. And then the whole Warren Court that just went super soft on crime and a lot of the whole prisoners' rights, criminals' rights, that big upswing that started in the mid to late 60s went through about 1994 or so. So, you know, you had a run-up of crime, but if you look from like the 70s to the mid-90s, crime was absurd and probably started seeping into people's brains. I got to have protection. And, you know, Bernie Goetz, whether he was a villain or a hero, a lot of people said, damn right. I mean, the guy actually had something to stop somebody on a subway.
Right. Are you gentlemen still here? It got quiet.
Well, I was going to say like a second ago, it's funny, like we all make fun of a right, you know, the mainstream for not understanding that politics follows culture. The guns are the one thing where like the NRA made a gun culture before this even became a legal issue. Since like the 1870s, I believe they were, sponsoring like marksmanship training and trying to make shooting popular, like, you know, sportsmen or recreation and all that. And so the gun culture is why we still have like, you know, pro-gun laws. Every other issue that was conservatives and losing for the last like 100 years even, there has been a culture behind it.
Yeah, that's a good point. A leftist talking point on the NRA is like, well, they were started, you know, because people were scared of the blacks that had just been freed, you know? And it's like, you can ironically, you know, make that a right talking point. It's like, damn right, you know, you disrupted society with a giant civil war, and so communities were insecure because there were, populations moving in that weren't really Western. And really didn't have the same values, and they were moving about the place. So, yeah, you can turn that around, you know, where they want to tar everything with the sin of racism, which is the only sin. There is no other sin. But you're like, well, from the standpoint of having a community, it's like, well, yeah, you've disrupted our society, and now we have strangers and aliens wandering about, you know, causing trouble. So, yeah, this gun culture has been in a response to the disruption caused by, you know, the central government, you know, messing up our society, messing up our local communities, you know. So I think, and you're right about the gun culture. It was the people that insisted that held the feet to the fire of the politicians who never wanted to do anything like that. They would never want to liberalize gun laws. I mean, they're special. They're the only ones. They're the elite. Why would they give weapons to the, you know, to the masses? But, you had to have people that were like, no, this is my only voting value. You know, no, I will fight you, you know, for the rest of your life. I will make, you know, on this issue. And, they finally got it through. And, the national media has been kind of trying to ignore it. It's gone state by state, you know, and finally the federal government through the Heeler decision has had to deal with it. You know, this giant cultural change that started from the bottom, you know, and that took, you know, 20 years, that took decades, you know.
One thing I'd say too, I'm part Anglo as well. I mean, it's an Anglo bit, you know, within white communities there are differences. And I think it's just that we are so good at following laws, and we do things so properly that, you know, like white culture, but especially Anglo-Saxon culture, like if you put in laws like what happened in Connecticut, okay, if you own certain guns, you need to register. They had people lining up to register. Now, if you went, you know, whether it was your Italian friend, somebody who's black, somebody who's Hispanic, well, I'm going to go, I'm not registering. I'm just going to keep it myself. Who cares? I'm just going to hide it. The idea of like law being gray is something that other ethnicities are better with, whereas us Anglos, we follow the law so well, and we believe in following the law because that builds civilization. You know, if everybody harbors around these laws, we're going to have a good civilization to live in. And that's something that unfortunately other groups have taken advantage of, whether it's, you know, Jews through legal loopholes, or just other groups saying, well, you know, you didn't define it exactly with that word in the law, so you can't bust me on it. I mean, it's something where we kind of fall prey to our own virtue.
Right. And that goes back to the weird thing of, the commons, you know, talking about white people in the commons, you know, the purpose of altruism is an in-group, you know, if altruism is extended to out-groups with no reciprocity, you destroy yourself, you remove your chromosomes, you lose the game. I mean, whether mathematics or biology, we know that altruism is for the in-group and Western Europeans have had this collective ownership of the commons. And a lot of the, you know, being nice and, you know, giving in the commons, well, that would have destroyed itself a long time ago if it wasn't reciprocated. So we have this strong culture of, you know, being nice and reciprocating it. And we're dealing with, you know, faithless contractors with other identities that do not reciprocate, you know, because they don't identify. You know, they're like, well, I want to, you know, raid the commons for my people, and why would I give in to you, you know?
Right, correct. There's a spirit of a law, and you know, a law originally like the Anglos. But if you get rid of those people, or at least, you know, outnumber them anyway, you know, other people, they'll interpret the law through their own perceptions and through their own, like, cultural, you know, heritage and whatnot, and they think, like, you know, the letter of a law reads differently to them.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll just, like, chuck it into the community. Like, the whole, like, certain free speech, free religion, like, freedom of religion, like any kind of property rights doesn't really mean much to them. Like on an individual level, it does, but collectively, if they can steal something from you or silence you, then that's it.
Yeah, and this goes back to a point of, you know, it's not really malice, it's just a lack of identification, you know, probably because, you know, the identity, the altruism factor is something ingrained into us. It's like, you know, when Jonathan Haidt talks about those moral sensibilities, and traditionalists have, you know, was it all five or six of the moral axes, that are just sentiments that, you rationalize later on, but you didn't start off with principles. These were general feelings. And then the left, you know, puts everything on, you know, the equality axis or the fairness axis, I believe it was. And, you know, so the left is this, advancing revolutionary vanguard that, you know, puts all their feelings on that, that fairness, that egalitarian thing. And, you know, as a libertarian, I suspect that, you know, it's because there's a great economic advantage to it. They're doing it because, you know, they're, benefiting from doing that. They're, you know, actually economically benefiting. Whereas the right, you know, that they have more in common with like, you know, a village in India or something. They have those same sentiments. You know, of, you know, purity and, you know, was it sanctity and all the other axes. This is just what normal people have. Whereas the left is, you know, Cthulhu's always swimming left, and they put all their energy up front, you know, on the egalitarian axis or the fairness axis. So I didn't mean to monopolize the conversation or change it there. But.
No, I was good to hear. I when I look at, you know, like when they talk about the whole, just start talking about egalitarianism, I think that stems from that whole, like the Boas, you know, blank slate, race is a social construct. And I think part of that goes back to when we were talking about the whole Eloy Morlock, combination of completely opposite people, you know, Swipple whites with, beige and black minorities is, I think that they want to believe in the blank slate because they don't want to come to the reality of who they're partnering up with to get their political way. Like, I don't think they want to think about who they're wrapping their arm around the shoulder of and go, hey, buddy, let's vote together. And if we vote together, you know, some guy in a wig will be able to piss next to, you know, because I say it's important, you know, some guy will be able to piss next to my daughter, or, you know, some homos will be able to get to marry. They don't want to realize that they're probably wrapping their arms around somebody who doesn't understand anything with the same complexity that they do.
Also, just look at these people themselves. They're not prime specimens either. I mean, I can see why you'd be an egalitarian at fat positive if you were some, like, these people, or like just a disgusting whale of a, like a woman. Oh, I was basically saying Sean Lass has articles on liberalism and self-esteem. And we're talking about, like, you know, like all of these, you know, cucky swipples and, like, fat women with tattoos and blue hair. And they're not, like, the best specimens. So I can see why you'd want to make everyone equal if you're not exactly a, you know, whatever, ubermensch.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, right-wingers tend to have a lot of other things that they tie their status up with, whereas left-wingers, it's always the cause, you know. It's always.
There's actually studies on that, too. It's I think it's called narcissistic supply, like the things that basically, like, you know, use to, like, affirm your self-image.
Right.
Well, one thing I – go ahead.
I mean, right-wingers have a more diverse narcissistic supply. You can get supply from, like, your occupation, like, you know, like, what does your wife look like, your hobbies, what is your physical appearance. Whereas liberals are theirs is more contingent on their political beliefs, and I think it's because it's kind of all they got.
Yeah, there were a couple of years ago I wrote a post about – I called the left-wing coalition, the, you know, the victim coalition. But a thing about the left-wing is that it's basically all the losers of Western civilization. and it's the losers of how we set up our society. Like you mentioned, you know, a loser in the dating market, you know, can you find somebody who's going to love you? Can you find somebody who's, you know, decent looking, who's going to love you, or, you know, that's a decent job? Are you someone who can make it in, you know, the work world or academia, or maybe not academia, but are you someone who can actually make it and make money? You know, when you can't do that, and if you take a look at the left's coalition, which is, as you mentioned, you know, like, say, fat women with tattoos, but, you know, single moms, losers in the dating market, minorities happen to be losers with being able to have a functional life, you know, and then the poor. I mean, there should be no surprise that folks who lose on a lot of other facets of life would want to partner up and get a win and have goods redistributed to them. So it's no real surprise there.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Megan, do you have something you'd like to add?
Not yet. No.
Okay. Well, Neo Reaction has a lot of, you know, interesting things that the alt-right may not know about or might be a little different or off by a few degrees. One of the things about Neo Reaction that I appreciate is that, you know, it deals with, you know, religion and, you know, religious sentiment. And it's not, you know, the alt-right deals more with identity politics. I think we're all on the alt-right, but, the alt-right that I'm usually, you know, deal with are the nationalist alt-right. And I wouldn't mind talking about, like, the theonomic or the fundy, whatever you want to call it, the one that deals with religious, the part of the neo-reaction that deals with this religious, you know, sentiment that we're fighting, you know. The alt-right has, Ganon. Which is God and nature's God, right?
Yeah. One thing I think that both sides are looking for, and I don't know whether it's just how to organize the society, but we're all looking for, I think, that cause or that shared belief that you want to build a society that transcends just let's grow GDP. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's the most disgusting thing about this whole immigration bit is they lie to us and they say, well, it helps GDP. You know, free trade helps GDP. Well, free trade might help GDP, but where does that GDP go? Because it hollowed out my hometown. Like, you know, right. My hometown had some mills in it. Those mills are gone. And, you know, those jobs now are across the ocean. My hometown fortunately could rework it and manage to supplement jobs with education and some service stuff, but some of the local communities didn't. And they're now hotbeds for heroin. So yeah, GDP went up, but at what cost? And I think both sides are looking for something spiritually, and whether that's white identity. And I do agree that alt-right goes more down towards whether it's white nationalism or white identity. I think NRX has that focus on pro-civilization and, you know, kind of, I almost say it's aspiring towards whether it's Renaissance era or the medieval era of perfecting the soul and working on yourself and then working on yourself and how you interact with your community. They're different ways to rally around, but we're both looking for ways to rally around besides our pocketbook. And I think that's a noble goal. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how these things progress.
Well, I think NRX is right. I mean, I think the whole religious sphere, which is like the weak leg of the tripod right now. But I think I think they're right about that because, you know, the symbol of fascism, the fascies, is a bundle of birch rods, you know, and, you know, working together, you know, they're unbreakable as a bundle, you know, and, I think that, you know, bringing in the religion, you know, will make your life, you know, whole. Everything's firing. Everything, you know, you have consilience where everything is working together. And that's what is so attractive about the Middle Ages is that, you know, the worldview, the classes, everything seems to be working together. And you don't have one class throwing another under the bus, you know, so to speak.
Well, yeah, you had that, you know, it was a very positive circular way that people were supporting one another where – whether you had your merchant class, your warrior class, your priest class, everybody was working in a way and understood that you could get status, whatever role you did, but you fit in as a piece with the whole. And that's something I'd go back to with the South that I think is fantastic about the South, where the warrior ethos is still there. There, you know, there's still value on masculinity. And like, when I go home to Maine or I talk to my friends in New England, I can just feel it, that just they're not as kind of macho. There's not as much machismo. And it's something so strange, because I remember my father's generation or my grandfather's generation, like our uncles, when our dads used to get together in the 80s, they were far more macho than what my friends are now. And it's something that's horrifying to see. And I think that when you've stripped out that masculinity, I think men forget what it takes to reaffirm each other and reaffirm the community, because they've been stripped of their role.
Macon, Mr. McMahon, do you have anything you'd like to add at this point?
You know what's interesting? I've noticed the libertarian response to, like, this, you know, heroin epidemic. And it's very whole. They miss the point all the time, because, like, nothing is sacred to them. And it's all kind of, like, superficial analysis. And their solution, of course, is, you know, just legalize heroin or legalize substitutes for heroin. Like, oh, why are they doing heroin? Like, the over jobs are going overseas. Oh, that's a free market. Like, oh, you're doing heroin? Okay, well, you know, just legalize heroin. Get better heroin.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the NRO article, which, you know, actually kind of celebrated the longevity of, you know, why it's going down, you know, because 45 to 55 people are dying from, you know, complications of drugs and stuff. Was it Williamson that wrote that NRO article?
And it's morally indefensible and deserve to die. That line. I love that line.
Yeah, that's again, you can totally attack whites. You can attack them with, you know, full force, full
and
he's
hatred. Written in the past about how, like, blacks are, like, perfect in progress. Like, they were just fine before, and then all the Democrats got involved, and then that's why they shoot each other and have illegitimate kids.
Certain demographics of whites. And again, our demographic in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a year ago, I wrote and it was something for Talkies, and it was called The Zombies of Fishtown. And what I wrote, and I love the, you know, personally, I love the fact that now people are paying attention to heroin in the heartland. But I wrote this article, and it was just talking about how every policy that, whether you were a neoliberal left winger or whether you were the right wing with the free trade and all that, you gutted out all those small towns, and now heroin's there. It just was waiting for him. And what hit home for me was there was a overdose back in my wife's hometown, and my wife grew up a town over from me. And the mother said, and she called the local paper up, and she said, "We're not saying that she died at home. We're not saying she died from an accident. We're going to say she died from an overdose, because people have to start talking about this." And at the same time she was talking about that, I was interacting with somebody who's a parole officer. They're no longer a parole officer. But they had one of their people, they call him a client, you know, one of the clients overdosed and died. And they started saying, "I could have told you the moment that person was assigned to me that they were going to end either in jail for 30 years or dead because of their life story." And I started asking them, "Well, tell me about what happened." And they started telling me about this town, Marion, Ohio. And it was, you know, just those working class whites. And it's sad what happened to that town. That town got gutted out. And a lot of manufacturing left. There was, like, one popcorn place that was left. But then, sadly, you know, they got secular. And people stopped going to church. And they didn't have a strong identity. It was kind of a company town in the late 1800s. So people came together just for jobs. Well, the jobs left, they didn't have anything to bind. And that's what I think helps the South, that people have an identity. And people have a strong shared community feeling. And I think that helps them keep heroin at bay compared to other regions of America. It's sad to see it happening where the elite just do not care.
Mm-hmm. Megan?
No, I mean, that was definitely a comment that I think I hadn't heard before, an insight. The part of Virginia where I happen to live, we're starting to see heroin starting to move in. And it's definitely starting to coincide with a period where we're starting to see deracination and a loss of identity. So, yeah, that would definitely, you know, sort of conform to that issue, where that thesis, where we're starting to see the lack of identity, you know, where identity was the thing that was keeping those sort of addictions out. It also sort of just sort of go ahead.
I was going to say, like, you know, somebody once joked me, one of my dad's friends had moved down to Virginia. He worked at Barnes. When he moved down there from Maine, he used to joke his daughters. He had like five daughters. He'd be like, hey, I might tell you that the Mason-Dixon line has moved down to the North Carolina-Virginia border, but my girls are still proper Southern girls. About that. But, you know, as Virginia, which has become now a purplish, more blue state, it's sad to see that, but I mean, I can believe that. The big thing for me is that heroin is a horrible drug with a horrible representation that wiped out, you know, a generation of musicians in the 70s, generation of musicians in the 90s. So when somebody's going down that path, it's not like in marijuana. It's not like somebody in college snorting a line or doing some E. You start doing heroin, that's a dark path. So the fact that we have, whether, I mean, I've seen user estimates between 500,000 and a couple million, even if it's just 500,000, the fact that we have 500,000 people are going, well, I was popping some oxys, now I'll inject myself with heroin. There's something gone where they don't have connections. They're atomized, as you had mentioned earlier on. They're atomized. They have no connection to church, no connection to community. They don't feel that there's anything that they can contribute, that there's no, and this gets to a NRX thing, there's no civilization that they're trying to build to honor their ancestors, but also build for their future. And that's something I think that's strong about the South, is that you have a past. It's a mythical past of the antebellum South. But there's also the connection of, you know, you're going to have children. If you look at birth rates for whites down South, they're still healthy. You want something you're going to build for the future, and you want to honor your past. And I think that's gone from, like, the Northeast, the upper Midwest. And that's where I think heroin's, where it's crept in.
Yeah. I noticed that, I was looking, at NRX, and, I noticed that, you guys, talk about Moloch as well. And, you know, over at the Right Stuff, we combined it with Dildo and called him Dildolek. You know, he's Moloch because you sacrifice your kids to it. He's Dildo, you know, because, it's an ersatz substitute for a natural relationship that you think is going to fill the hole in your soul, you know? And, I think that's, you know, this spiral of degeneracy, you know, when you start going on your way to heroin, it's like a demonic possession. And it's like, you know, there's real healthy relationships that you need, you know, to be happy and to, you know, for your soul. And these people are looking after these substitutes. They're going after them to replace the relationship that's been destroyed. And I think just originally because it's, you know, it's a war against us, you know, to extract our labor, the fruits of our labor or our capital. It's a war being waged by DC. And that's another, you know, element that I, you know, since I'm a libertarian, I always emphasize that. And as a Southerner, you know, that the imperial capital is our enemy. You know, it's not something that we can vanguard, take over, and simply have, you know, the nation of our choice. You know, it would rather destroy us than let us do that. And it's destroying us right now, slowly, but surely, you know, to live off of us, you know, because they don't work for a living. But, I think Dildolek is, how I would, I just wanted to add, Dildolek there, you know, the substitute for a real relationship.
You know, there is something Ryan mentioned about the like kind of libertarian view of, you know, legalize everything and see how it goes. And, you know, when I talk to police officers, there's a big chunk of them that says, let's legalize things, regulate it, and force it to go through, you know, legal distributors. As they said, that'll kill off cartel violence down in Mexico. It'll make our border safer. And as they say, like, you know, you're not going to have a lot of the weird ODs. And then the flip side of it is, I always go to them, I'm like, you know, and I know, if they ever legalized it, just like you got Nicorette gum, someone's going to come up with opium gum. You know, they're going to give you just enough to feel good, but not enough that it's going to destroy you. You know, like how beer is 3% alcohol. The other part of it, and this cop said it to me, and he said, that's a good point, but you got to remember that you're going to go through 10 years of hell. And I said, well, what are you talking about? He goes, there would be 10 years where once you legalize something, everybody, you know, everybody who's wanting to do it is going to do it, and they're going to do it till they die. He goes, but at the end of those 10 years, you're going to have kind of had a die off, if you will, of the dysfunctional and the folks who have more addictive personalities. But you're also going to have 10 years of people being able to look at destroyed lives and saying, okay, I'm not doing this. I'm not touching this. And,
yeah.
Where he said, like, we'd almost be healthier by just having it, going through the pain, and then breaking through.
Yeah. What's hidden and what's out in the open is very interesting. Like, the biggest drug dealers in the United States are big pharma. We have a prescription pill epidemic that, for some reason is not as, you know, as visible and as talked about as, you know, the past drug epidemics, you know, like the drug epidemics of my youth. But it is absolutely, you know, it's pervasive and it's devastating. And big pharma, you know, makes money off of every one of those pills that it sells. And I, you know, to me, you know, I think that, you know, some of this public policy that we're talking about, whether to legalize or to, you know, not, you know, keep it illegal, you know, these different drugs. You know, to me, a lot of this is like, it's actually the place for religion. You know, cause when you're talking about saving someone from their addictive personality or from their bad habits, you're really talking about saving their soul. And, you know, that's, you know, you can't use the sword and the jail cell to do that. You can save their body, but you know, you're going to probably ruin their soul in the process. You know, so, you know, I almost view it as, you know, Caesar's trying to replace, you know, that traditional institution, that local institution, that, you know, the church or, you know, religion, you know, trying to save people's souls with these, you know, rehab clinics and everything else. I view it as, you know, a religious endeavor. And, like you said, you know, we're going to lose some people. And, you know, and that's, but that's up to them. That was their choice. You know, that they chose that was more important than, you know, being a good son or being a good father or being a hard worker. And, you know, I'll help them any way I can, but it's ultimately their choice. But, you know, that's saving someone's soul as opposed to protecting someone from another person's aggression, you know, the drug stuff. So I always like to add that, you know, when libertarians, you know, talk with the, you know, the police staters about, you know, what are we going to do with these drug epidemics? It's like, well, it's a religious issue, gentlemen. You know, I just want to, as long as I can blow away, you know, burglars and, you know, you're going to lock up people that attack me. You know, it's like, you know, as for saving their soul, that's the church. It's not me.
Yeah.
You know, or it's not me as the citizen that's paying, the tax paying citizen. So, but, I just figured I'd throw that out there.
I think it also brings us back, pretty interesting to the discussions we had with some of the League of South guys with, just the discussions we had about Calvinism and the idea that man is inherently fallible and that we need to understand that we can't perfect man. And that's something we need to just be aware of with any legal policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's because human nature humans tend to rationalize their own advantage and lie to themselves and are strangers to themselves. That's, you know, that's what innate depravity means to me. And, well, that's interesting because that's an area where I totally agree with the Calvinists, and yet neo-reactionists sort of famous for the Puritan thesis, throwing that out there. So, Mr. Landry, what do you think of the Puritan thesis?
I like to describe our current predicament as we are in a weird mix of Protestant universalism, Jewish Bolshevism, and it's in a blender and with a dose of Brazilian demographics.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's because unfortunately, you know, the universalist pieces, Protestants are going to want to signal their virtue, signal their holiness, and they're going to want to make sure you do exactly as they do. They're not going to leave you be. The Jewish Bolshevism is easily on display with everything with our culture. And unfortunately, they're importing third worlders, which makes it even worse.
Yeah, they want us to be a minority. That's whether they know it or not, that's their every motive, or that's their motive for their every action is, you know, they don't want to live in a majority country where, you know, a majority besides themselves exists.
Yeah. Or at least they're acting that way and their policies are very quickly going to have that effect intentionally or not.
Yeah, well, that's their identity. You know, that's their identity politics, which, you know, is natural, and they don't have, it doesn't have to be rational. It doesn't have to be part of the, you know, their awareness.
Yeah, their conscious awareness.
Yeah. But, the Protestant or the Puritan thesis, it reminds me of how, you know, the, being a Southern Calvinist, and I will throw this out here because we talked about it once before. You know, for some reason, the Southern Calvinists are like the opposite. You know, if you're talking about Sam Francis or Jared Taylor or, you know, Dabney, these are just reactionary to the core people, just naturally, or that's their culture. And, they've been fighting this a long time. And I think it's, interesting how, you know, they went and created a Calvinist utopia up in New England, and then it became, you know, secular, and then it imposed its values on the rest of the country, especially after the Civil War, which is the, you know, like the Puritan thesis. But they're using the state as some sort of substitute for the church, you know, because these are often people that, you know, would laugh at, you know, your supernatural superstitions or something. Yeah. But they have this supernatural superstition and equality, you know, and it happens to serve, the policy of our overlords, of the managerial class, whatever you want to call them, the Brahmins. So, you know, I think that's interesting. That's what happened. Yeah, you're right. It's a religious, you know, event, but the state has been substituted for the church, something like that. and the Southern Calvinists didn't get their way.
I'll because I do got to get going, but I'll wrap up with a story just about I'm of the mindset that America is like, you know, five or six countries within our borders, and that's probably how we're going to break. But I was recently at a business conference, and there was somebody who was doing a presentation, and she was from New England, and I was there with a contingent that was more Northwest and Southern guys and women. And so this woman steps up and she's talking and doing her presentation. She goes, well, you know, me and my wife, we just recently got a dog. So like, I can't sleep. And then she kept talking. She acted like nothing had happened. She acted like it was nothing. So after the presentation, we have a break and we're all getting sodas and everybody's just kind of talking about the last presenter. And then one woman goes, okay, I'm going to say it. Did she say she had a wife? And we all started laughing and I'm like, yeah. And this woman who's married and has three kids goes, okay, I can't believe she just nonchalant said that. So some of the other folks were saying, yeah, I really didn't know that about Jill. And I said, look, guys, I grew up there. I moved away from Massachusetts. When I was there, they were just starting gay marriage. And let me tell you, they were already on your ass about approving it. I said, you guys are just finally catching up. Like, they're just finally getting to you to approve it. But believe me, a decade ago, if you were going to voice, like, what the hell's going on with that in Massachusetts, in the heart of the progress of the Prague utopia, you would have gotten weird looks by deeming it inappropriate. So, I mean, they're the forefront. They're the vanguard for everything that's weird coming our way.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're winding down, Macon, Mr. McMahon, do you have any questions or final points that you would like to make?
Basically their kid.
Yeah. No, I don't. I definitely appreciate Ryan Landry for coming on. I also appreciate your whole multiple nations within the United States thesis, just because you're the only person who has agreed with me so far on that. So that part's cool.
Well, thank you guys for having me. But here's another thing I always say. Go to a gosh darn grocery store in Georgia, Indiana, California, Massachusetts. Go. And don't even buy anything. Just look. Look at people. And you tell me that they're all in one nation, and that's crap.
Yeah. Having lived there, been stationed there on active duty, I can tell you for a fact that we are not the same nation, just as I can tell you that New York or the Midwest is not the same nation as the South.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Landry, why don't you do some shameless self-promotion? Like, where do you – what blog should we go to? And
The blog that I post to multiple times a week is 28sherman.blogspot.com. I write at Social Matter. That's socialmatter.net.
And you have a podcast too, right?
Yeah. Every Sunday I've got my post at Social Matter that goes up. And every Wednesday I have what's called Wimerica Weekly. I just talk about the strange, odd situation of America. As other people, bigger journalists have been calling it Weimar America. Like a year or so ago or a year and a half ago, I had a post where I talked that, yes, we were very similar to 1920s Germany, which was Weimar Germany. I called it Weimerica. So once a week, I talk about something strange, how it fits in politically into the big picture, as well as discussing it. This week, I talked about the hubbub of, you know, blacks boycotting the Oscars and how far that goes back. And it actually goes back 20 years ago with Hollywood and blacks agitating, and then just how that fits into what this current situation is today. So thank you guys very much, though, for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Landry. And would you ever like to come back on? Because I don't feel like we had enough talk.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, would you like to do that further in the future or pretty soon? Because I'd like to keep on talking to you. We don't have enough neo-reactionaries, on TRS radio, if you ask me. So.
Whenever the itch comes up, you know, just let me know. And I would say if we ever have a situation like last year with – I called it the week of fags and flags, where it was the gay marriage thing got approved and then 3 days later – the world went against the Confederate flag. So if something like the week of fags and flags happens, I'd definitely come on and talk.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for coming on.
Life is so strange when it's changing, yes, indeed. Well, I've seen the hard times and the pressure's been on.
like a working man do. And I got my act together, gonna walk all over you. Give me back my bull ass. Put them back where they belong. Ain't fooling around, cause I've done had my fun. Ain't gonna see no more damage done. Give me back my bull ass. People done ran me out of town, and I drank enough of whiskey to throw the battleship around. Now I'm leaving this game one step ahead of you, and you will not hear me cry, cause I do not sing the blues. Give me back my bill ass.
Thank you.